Welcome back to Shadows from the Tree. We're your hosts, Danielle
and Michelle,
and this week we're exploring the dark genealogy theme of industrial accidents. And I'm really excited to find what your story was about because I really was quite involved in mine, and again, emotional, and I just wanted to keep digging and digging into the family. So
yeah, I remember you brought this topic up.
Yeah,
and you were like, I have a story, I really want to do this, and I feel like this is a good topic.
Yeah, this has been on the back burner for like since last season. Yeah. So
that's good, we get to finally hit that. Yeah. And I was watching Poldark. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's like,
I saw that one.
It's a BBC like masterpiece PBS show. And they have a mine that they work out of, and there's like some accidents that happen in the mine. So I figured, I was like, oh, I feel like that's a good topic. There's definitely got to be some kind of mining incident. And I don't know, this season I've really looked at Appalachia a lot. And guess where I ended up?
Oh dear.
In West Virginia. So
it's been a hot place on the map for us.
Yep. So back up in the mountains, this happened December 6th, 1907. It was a Friday morning in Monongah, West Virginia. So it began like any other day for hundreds of immigrant miners heading to the Fairmont Coal Company mines. So they had two specific mines that were like bigger and more well run than the others. So they had mine number 6 and mine number 8. But at about 10:30 a.m., everything changed.
It only takes a split second.
Yeah. So before the boom. So let's talk about like what the town was like a little bit before. So Monongah, it was a small mining town. It had those two main mines, number 6 and number 8. They were the company's most productive. And on that morning, official records showed that 420 men were on that company roster for the two mines. So but the reality is a little bit more grim. So there were a lot of off the book labor too. So there were children and some other relatives and other day laborers that were actually may have gone underground, and the numbers could be even higher than that.
Right.
So the working population was mostly immigrants. So Italians, Hungarians, Eastern Europeans, Russians. So they were drawn to that promise that coal was where they could earn steady wages.
Yeah. It just makes you think, because this ties a little bit to my story too about, you know, immigrants, that how bad did they have it in their home country that they come over, and yes, wealth was probably the top of their mind, but like that's harsh work.
And how was that American dream sold so rapidly?
Yeah, like, it's true.
Like, whose idea was that you could go to this brand new place, and I don't know, it seemed to spread like wildfire.
It really did.
Right? Like this brand new land of hopes and dreams and promises, and then they get here.
Maybe newspapers?
Maybe, I don't know.
Like, I'm gonna dig into that.
Yeah, our founders were really good at selling something that probably definitely wasn't.
Yeah, it was hard.
Accurate.
It was very hard, yeah.
So, you know, that morning, all the miners, they were walking down into the shaft. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Some of them were children, and some of them were under the age of 12 even, going down to work down there to help, you know, with the family and earning some wages. So they're saying it happened about 8:28, the disaster struck. So a massive explosion, likely caused by there's kind of two hypotheses. It was like a blown out shot or some ignited coal dust.
Oh.
Yeah. So according to later coroner reports, it forced a collapse of the shafts and destroyed ventilation in like minutes. So the initial rescue teams braved choking dust, collapsing timbers, deadly gases when they entered the mine. The conditions were horrific, so many were trapped underground.
I'm surprised people tried to go in to save them, considering all that, what they would have physically seen.
Well, they couldn't go down for long. They could only be in for a couple minutes, and they'd have to come back out because they were going to die from, like, the gas poisonings.
The gear and the things.
Because they have these, there's pictures on, there's lots of pictures of the aftermath. So they had these huge fans that would blow like the gases out. So even when they were working like a daily regular shift, they were like the fans were supposed to be like exhausts, like pulling out all those gases. But if it got blown out, so there's no more fans, there's no more ventilating, and they were just like stuck, suffocating. And it like collapsed around them, and like even if there were groups of pockets, like how long did they have? It's really,
and in those circumstances you kind of you just hope that it went quick for them, right?
Yeah,
like that could have been torture.
Yeah, just slowly stop breathing, like otherwise I don't know how long. Ugh, that's, I'm gonna tear up. But
yeah,
it's really dark about. Really dark. So they were, a lot of them couldn't be reached, they were trapped. So the official death toll, they have like a museum, it says there's 362 miners. The names were recorded by the company matching their payroll lists and like accounts.
Missing people, yeah.
Right. Families. But if you think about it, they're immigrant workers. Not everyone's able to communicate.
True.
The same, like how many names were missed, how many people were left out.
The family tree. You might be missing someone and not even know.
Yep. There's a notable historian, his name J. David McAder. He argued that numbers were dramatically undercut, and it was like even more based on, he was comparing church registers, the payroll from the company, relief committee files, and then some immigrant surveys. And he suggested that there were more like 488 men that died, and possibly as many as 550.
Wow. Yeah. So he was looking at it from like a community standpoint, right, trying to account for everyone
trying
in the community.
Like, you know, mix and match the names and like, was this spelling versus that?
And, right. And then with the immigrants, yeah, everyone was getting their name butchered.
Yeah. You know? Exactly.
Wow.
Yep.
I mean, so, good on him though for trying to actually.
Yeah. Even he was using newspaper accounts, and he found an additional 13 in the newspaper that weren't on the company payroll. So,
wow.
Like they said, like, how are they even getting paid if they weren't on the payroll? Were they just
sketchy
down there? Yeah.
Oh no, under the table work. Yep. It's the thing.
So there's lots of discrepancies. It was reflected in the chaos, you know, poor record keeping of the day and willful underreporting of the immigrant labor. So yeah. Was it like we were paying the father for the 10-year-old's work? Like, is that what was happening? Who knows?
It could very well be.
And were they getting like a percentage of a full laborer's
can't even think
work
about it.
You know, that's probably what was
child
happening.
Child labor laws, I
yeah.
just...
They got an extra nickel if their kid worked with them. Or yeah, that's what I'm imagining happened.
Probably.
So...
Guys.
Yep. So behind the numbers, they were real people. So
yeah.
Families, like we said, that American dream, all those hopes were shattered. So some of the names that appeared in the relief committee records, the coroner's inquest, and like the other documentation, there was a man named Peter Urban. He was one of the few survivors. He was found sitting next to his injured brother. His name was I don't want to butcher, but it's Stanislaus Urban. So okay. The papers referred to him as Stan. He later passed away. His brother was sitting with him for 5.5 hours. Aww. Like as he would like, you know,
dying, so, basically.
Yeah,
the poor, that's sad. That's so sad. What yep. harsh conditions. If it just makes you grateful for, you know, us today, what we right. have. And you know, obviously the world has still got some progress.
There's still
to make,
coal mines. I was like, there's still coal mines. They're still digging out the coal. It's a non-renewable source, so they just have to keep
like labor, like it. Like with
yes
men
miners
going
are
down?
Going down. Really? Yes. I mean, I'm hoping there's better conditions,
right.
But like, think
more
about
safety.
It. Who's, they have that, the black lung that they get, yeah. And like, it's still an issue. It's still, I don't know.
Wow. And it's surprising that with the technology we have that there haven't, I mean, maybe there are different, like you said, changes, well, but.
Yeah, those big companies, do you think they want to give up their coal money?
Yeah, true.
You think solar is, they like any of that, but. Anyways, I digress. So the brothers managed to run when the explosion first struck, but like I said, Peter stayed with his brother who had ended up falling. And so there's just many Italian families, including them. Probably the most devastated was the DeSalvo family. There's like records show that this family lost 10 family members.
10?
Yeah. So some of the names were, like, lost here or there, but the most, name that was seen often was an 11-year-old, Fior Angelo, who died.
Oh.
So many of the minors in that family weren't officially registered, so I'm thinking it was a lot of children, right?
Yeah. Oh, that is so sad.
Yep. So that was part of the Italian Sons and Daughters of America, community historians. Yeah. So exact first names, they're not reliable on the payroll list. And then there was also a coroner's jury. After examining evidence, they declared that about 350 others were among the dead. Beyond the names that were in the payroll. So they had, like, you know, they wanted to interview survivors, workers who had been there, like locals, to see what had happened. And there was lots of questionings, like, did you see what happened? So there was, like, a discussion of there was a cart that might have been released. And as it was going down in, it caused a spark in the coal dust. And then, you know, with those gases that are in there, it just caused an explosion. Yeah, that's the mostly accepted version of what was thought to happen.
Yeah.
But, of course, the company was, it was miners' misconduct that caused it. It wasn't because it wasn't properly ventilated or whatever. It could be their cause. They're the blame. So... so let's talk about like what happened above ground now, with like the widows and the people who were.
Yeah, I got questions too. Yeah.
So as the miners were stuck below, the town above became, chaos and grief and lots of uncertainty. So there's so many pictures. Wait till you see these pictures of groups of women, wives, mothers, sisters walking back and forth, like
just pacing
across the tracks between the mines, looking for their loved ones, listening for news. Some of the widows walked for over 20 hours without food or sleep. Okay,
so my eyes are like tearing because I'm such an empathetic person. Yeah. And I could like feel their pain.
I know,
right?
I got like goosebumps, right? So the pictures are even like, they add to it because they're just walking and they all look devastated, and it's December in the mountains.
It's freezing cold,
and they're just walking trying to find any news. Like, I don't know, it's just heartbreaking. It's really so heartbreaking. Really bad,
especially if they have their children down there.
Yeah,
can you imagine?
Yep. So other towns and relief started coming in. So relief efforts began almost immediately. So the Monaga Mine Relief Committee formed and started raising funds, aided by individuals, church groups, and even foreign embassies. So there was a Hero Fund. It was associated with the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission. So they started sending investigators and money and supplies right to the community as quick as they could. So I'll talk more about the verdict too. So on January 16th, 1908, there was a coroner's jury issued its verdict. It declared that the explosion was caused by that coal or the spark. But there was back and forth conflicting testimony. So there was a jury named A.H. Morris, Charlie McCain, and John M. McGraw. And then they said there was over 350 people who came to their death that day.
So was it like a lawsuit? Did they get compensation for it? Or no, because it was...
It wasn't like... The company wasn't sued, but the company did pay a lot of relief to these families. Okay. But Italy, because they had some of the highest numbers of people in this town, they actually paid for, like, if the wives or the widows or the children wanted to come back to Italy, they paid for their voyage back.
Are you kidding?
Right? You never hear of that.
I've never heard of
that. No, but there was, like, it was such a devastation to their
community.
The community that they were, like, established in Italy. So I think the family members that were still in Italy were probably like, we need them back. Help us to get them back here.
It would be so interesting to know the percentage that took that offer.
Yeah. I'm sure we could see it in the records, like the voyage back over to Italy. We would just have to pull some more info from Ancestry. I think we could definitely look into that.
Because on one hand, do you want to stay in a place where now you have this, you know,
this dark
scene over you, hovering
darkness over you. And like they were talking about how the holidays, like Christmas, was only a few weeks later, and then they in one of the articles, it pictured a widow and like all the empty seats around the holiday.
I really need to see those photos after.
Yeah.
My question is like, you talk about the chaos of the town. Like after everyone's like, the bodies are probably, you know, brought out or brought up. What does burial look like? Like, can you imagine that
there's pictures. So,
oh gosh,
they had the company talk about what the company did after. So they ordered like 200 coffins, like pine coffins. Wow. And once they were realizing that wasn't enough, they just kept adding like, these coffins, you see them piled in the pictures, and then they're pulling them by horse-drawn carriage, six at a time on the carriage up to the final resting place. So there's a cemetery that's just
dedicated,
but it's a mass burial, because even if you go to the West Virginia Vital Records, like I looked, there's it just says like unknown. It just says unknown, 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 unknown. So there's hundreds of unknown names. Like they're just all together in
Oh, my eyes, I know.
That's a big one. Yeah.
That's very sad.
Yep. And then there's some quotes from some of the survivors. So some of the women didn't feel like they could trust reporters or people who worked for the mine company. So it's not their native language. So after telling her sad story, one woman, she wrote her name down on a slip of paper for a reporter. But when the reporter was leaving, she told another young woman that she had done wrong. She was fearing that she felt like she signed away something, or like she was like agreeing that, like,
so scared.
She was just afraid of what signing her name on something was going to do. So she became hysterical. She ran after the reporter, but they said, okay, we'll erase your name. And like they said they didn't want to talk. She didn't want to talk to anybody because she was just afraid everything was going to be used against her, and she didn't have anything at all. So, you know, they're afraid, they're alone. I'm just...
Oh, yeah. Again, the language barrier, the no income coming in anymore. I'm sure there's a bazillion things going through their head.
Yeah, there was... So there was a William Vokalek, too. So during the inquest in January, this was part of his testimony. He said, I never seen at all. I tried to get out, but couldn't see. It was just knocked down. He could only see smoke and heard lots of noise for about 10 minutes. So it was through a interpreter. So he was giving a really visceral, disorientating account of what it was like right after the explosion. So he said it was total darkness, chaos. He was like choking on smoke. Yeah.
Yeah.
Deep breaths.
Yeah.
So it was really, really a terrible incident that happened. There was, you know, a legacy that came from this.
Yeah.
So after this happened, there was a federal agency. So they established, what was it called? It was the formation of the U.S. Bureau of Mines. So there was more regulations on like the ventilation, safety protocols, things like that. So although the Monaga Mines Relief Committee records preserve the details, so there's lots of places of birth in the records, ages, dependents, and the payments they received from that relief committee too. Wow. So that's a really good source of information that I looked through. So, yeah, on that day, it was more than 100 years ago, hundreds of men walked down into the darkness, and many never came out. So we do have a few names, and the newspapers did publish, there's probably 100 or so names in the newspapers. So Peter and Stanislaus Urban, countless DeSalvos, and hundreds more. So they echo in the archives, on memorials, and in the memories of those families who survived too. So we may never know how many lives were lost, but we can still remember them. So there is a museum, and there's lots of other archival information that if you wanted to look more into it, it would be...
Yeah, or if you have a descent, you know, an ancestor that this happened to, we'd love to hear your research or just thoughts.
Or the oral history that was passed down that, you know, maybe in other languages could have been lost in our newspapers. So,
Wow, that was a good one, Michelle.
Thanks.
And I said good one, but why do we do this to ourselves? It's so sad. I
know. Both on the verge of tears, just barely keeping it together.
We have to, but it's important to tell the family stories. And,
yeah,
you know, it's industrial accidents did wipe out multiple people, usually.
Right.
And they happened often, you know.
And we did get some regulations out of it. True. So maybe it made it safer for a few others. I did forget to mention that Peter did end up passing away in another mine accident in 1926. Peter. So 19 years later.
Well, so Peter was there really better regulations?
I guess not. I don't know. Yeah. So he was, I don't know if it was just his fate to follow, but like what other work could he have done?
True. I was going to say, like, how could you go back to doing that without having all that trauma? Yeah. I don't know. But I will say, again, industrial accidents, like, you'll hear some similarities in my story.
Okay.
And I think it's just the common theme of these.
Right.
So
it's dark, that time of the work era, that industrial revolution.
Yep. But anyway. All right. Get my composure here. So, so my story, I'll be curious at the end to know if, like, you knew any of these details. Again, being in New England, this is where my story took place. So we'll see. All right, here we go. So, Boston, 1919. The air was thick with the scent of molasses, sweet, heavy, and strange. And then, in a single instant, that sweetness turned deadly. A wave of malted syrup taller than a house tore down the North End streets like a living thing, swallowing everything in its path. 21 lives were lost, but one family's name would echo through courtrooms, graveyards, and generations. So, in 1919, Boston's North End was a world within itself. It was a tight maze of cobblestone streets between the harbor and the rising city skyline. There was a smell of baking bread and roasting chestnuts coming from the tenement windows, mixing with that salt air from the docks. There was laundry lines stretching across the alleyways, just like improvised banners, and children darting through the streets shouting in a tangle of English and Italian. So I don't know if you know, but the Boston North End had a lot of Italian immigrants.
Right.
So, most families were immigrants from southern Italy. They were laborers, masons, longshoremen, and people who crossed an ocean for steady work and a brighter future.
Here's our American dream.
Yep. So, days started before sunrise and ended long after dark. Homes were cramped, loud, but full of life, and neighbors looked out for one another when no one else would. But it wasn't just a neighborhood, it was an active industrial port, and molasses was a big business. Towering over all of it was the Purity Distilling Company, a subsidiary of the U.S. Industrial Alcohol Company, with their massive molasses tank, a hulking steel giant perched above Commercial Street at the North End. It was the perfect location because ships arriving from the Caribbean could offload it directly into the massive tank, where it would later be processed into industrial alcohol, used from everything from rum to wartime tools. The tank stood in the North End simply because it was convenient, profitable, and at that time barely regulated, making it the perfect place for a company to store as much molasses as they could, pushing through production as fast as they can.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was leaking, this tank. Children would scoop the sticky drips coming from the leaks, licking their fingers of it. workers heard rumbling, groaning, you know, metallic shudders, which, you know, was reported that they did tell people, but it was just dismissed, and it was never trustworthy in their eyes. On the cold January day of 1919, that distrust proved valid. The recently filled tank holding an estimate of 2.3 million gallons of molasses.
Million?
Mm-hmm. 2.3 million gallons of molasses ruptured violently.
Yikes.
And within minutes, the close-knit Italian neighborhood was engulfed by a roaring wave of sticky, relentless molasses. Yes, I know.
It sounds comical, but I'm sure it was terrifying.
Yeah, yep. So, I'm going to explain some of the people who died, so don't get me for butchering their names. But 21 souls were lost when the tank exploded, each one caught in a moment when ordinary life turned to chaos. Laborers like Patrick Breen, John Callahan, and William Duffy were working in the paving yard when the wave struck. Teamsters William Brogan, Eric Layard, Peter Shaughnessy, and James Lennon were swept away while doing the everyday work that kept Boston running. Bridget and Stephen Clowerty, were mother and son, were crushed while they were in their home when it collapsed. Blacksmiths Peter Francis and John Cyberlick, drivers like Flamino Gallerini and Ralph Martin, foremen, longshoremen, and firefighters, the men who built the city with their hands, never stood a chance. Firefighters George Leahy died rushing towards danger. Others like Cesar Nicoli, Thomas Noonan, and Michael Sinnott represented the city's working heart. Lives ended by a disaster that could not have been foreseen. Each name is a whole story, ordinary people lost to extraordinary negligence. But among them was the youngest victim of all, 10-year-old Maria D'Estacio. Her short life and her family's long fight would become the emotional core to my story because, again, a child who never got a chance to see. So, so really, to understand the human cost, we are going to look at the D'Estacio family specifically. They were immigrant, from Italy, whose American dream was forever changed by this day of the flood. Vincenzo is the father's name. He arrived in Boston in 1902 aboard the Canopic from Naples, and his wife, Carmela, followed in 1903. Neither could read or write, as it was detailed in the 1920 census, but they carried ambition, resilience, and the willingness to work hard. They married in Boston on January 13, 1906, and between 1907 and 1924, they had 9 children.
Wow.
Can you imagine being pregnant for that long? Just I read that, and I was just like, whew, doozy. It's like, so here are their children's name in the order of their birth. So we have Assuntia, which went by Susan, Maria, so she was the second oldest, Anthony, Jenny, Americo, who is nicknamed Rico, Angelina, Mary, Carmela, and James. So by 1917, the family lived at 115 Charter Street, which was a cramped tenement near the waterfront. Vincenzo, he worked at the Bethlehem Shipbuilding Corporation. Long hours, heavy labor, and barely enough pay, I'm sure, for his large growing family.
Right.
And I, of course, went on Google Maps. I'm just like looking just around the area. Mm-hmm. And you see these like large brick tenement buildings where you can imagine lots of immigrant families probably just piling in there trying to do their best to make a living. And there really is, it's kind of made me just think that on the map you could see where they were living and where the accident happened was just like literally across the street.
Yeah. So where the houses, you know, a lot of our mill towns, like the mill owners build houses for their work. It was true. That the situation?
I don't know, because the whole area was like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's just... Maybe. I didn't go that deep back into the history, but it was definitely just gave me a feeling I could like envision the family there and, you know.
Yeah. Tight quarters, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
So on the day of the flood, Carmela was pregnant. She was going to have a baby who would be Mary, born 6 months later. 10-year-old Maria was walking home with from the Michelangelo School with her brother Anthony, who would have been about 8. And when they heard the extremely loud explosion, the massive wave, report saying initially about 25 feet high,
what?
And the surge outward at an estimate of 35 miles per hour overtook them. There were physics scientists that all like took all this data and came to this very specific details.
Like a tsunami?
Yeah, of molasses.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
Did they know why it blew up?
Oh yeah, well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Just like yours, you know, yeah. People try not to get the blame.
Of course.
But so Anthony ran one way, his sister the other. She died and he survived, barely. Per the Boston Globe interview with Anthony in 1990, he was able to grab a pole extended by a firefighter perched on a lamppost. He said he could hear his mother crying to him. Mm. And he quoted, "I couldn't answer. I was choking on molasses."
Oh, no.
Yeah, I could just...
God.
I just relate to the mother just in fear, massive fear. He would carry that story in a scar on the top of his head for the next 80 years. Maria's death certificate lists it plainly, as quoted, asphyxia by immersion in a molasses.
Oh my gosh. That's not very common, right?
No.
How many deaths were there total?
So there was the 21.
21, wow.
But there were so many more injured.
Right.
Because wait till you see the pictures, I mean. And maybe you've seen them in the past, but it wrecked everything in that area.
Yeah, I didn't know the details. I've heard of it before, but wow. Yeah. It's crazy.
Brings it to a whole new level because I remember I wanted to do the story because I distinctly remember elementary school and reading and learning about this.
Yeah.
I don't remember any of the details, but it stuck in my head.
It's weird. It sticks, yeah. Yes. Molasses.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So now that I'm like reading back, I'm like, gosh, I can't imagine that they told me all the details of elementary school. No, it's so
I'd hope
sad.
Not.
So now we'll get to some justice. So even in the shadows of such heartbreak and loss, the North End slowly began to rebuild, and in the years that followed, the long legal battle over the disaster unfolded, earning the title of the longest and most complex civil case in Massachusetts history up to that time. The Boston Globe on January 16th, 1925 documented the findings. So Auditor Hugh W. Ogden appointed in 119 lawsuits.
Wow.
Stemming from the January 15th, 1919 collapse of the molasses tank holding again over the 2.3 million gallons, ruled that the United States Industrial Alcohol Company was liable for the disaster that killed the 21 people and caused massive property damage. Originally built for the Purity Distilling Company, the tank's failure was attributed to faulty construction, is what they came out with. Ogden's investigation was enormous, spanning more than 3 active years of investigating, including testimony from 920 witnesses, 200,672 pages of records, and 1,584 exhibits.
Wow.
He assessed over $250,000 in damages, including $6,000 for each victim's family and $30,000 to the city of Boston, with additional railway claims still pending because it, like, uprooted some of the railway tracks and all of their stuff as well. So despite the scientific disputes presented by experts, Ogden concluded that the essential facts were clear. The tank failed, and the company was responsible. But to your point, the company was throwing out, I mean, they disputed every single claim that they were trying to go against saying. Just,
of course.
Which why it took so long. So from the time of the disaster to the time they actually had a decision was 6 years. So quite a long time. But again, the people around them didn't probably have anywhere else to go, right. And so just had to rebuild and sort of move forward. So this case, like yours, became a turning point in the American industry, a landmark acknowledged of corporate negligence and a warning that cutting corners on safety could no longer be ignored. While the flood itself was tragic, it ultimately helped prevent future industrial catastrophes by ushering in stricter building standards, stronger safety regulations, and clearer legal accountability for companies.
That's good.
Yeah.
It just really, like, cutting the corner, does it really, like, you're going to save money, but
in the end,
lives,
you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll never, there'll be never an amount of money you can give a parent. Right. Or family member who've lost somebody. There's just none. You can't. So the Stachios rebuilt as the best they can, they could. And in 1930, they achieved something remarkable for their, you know, for their family. I'm assuming helped by the money given from the lawsuit, but they bought their own home at 203 Salem Street. Again, me on, you know, that one, that building still did appear to be there, that specific one. So that was really cool to see. And it's just, I know, money can't get you anything, but for them, on the census, it was literally like everyone else around them was rent, and they owned it. $7,500 was the value, which back then is quite a lot. And even for the family getting $3,000, $6,000, whatever it was, like in today's time, that's doesn't seem like a lot now, but...
substantial.
For them, yeah. So Carmela never had to experience the loss of another child in her lifetime, and she died in 1937 in Boston at the age of 55. I would like to go back and try to figure out how she died, because that's still quite young, but I ran out of time for that. Vincenzo lived long enough to experience the loss of a second child. His son, Americo, killed in France in 1944 during World War II, and he was listed as a private first class. And then in 1966, Vincenzo was last seen living with his daughter, Angelina, and her family, and he died in... In 1957, he died at the age of 72. So he was last seen in 1940 living with his daughter.
And he remarried at all?
Didn't remarry. And one of his older son was also living with him at the time.
Nice.
So several years later, after both parents have died, a third sibling, James, would die before his time. At 38 years old, in 1963, he collapsed at work, and he was working in the Callahan Tunnel. Again, didn't do a deep dive, but I'm assuming it had to do something, not from an accident, but just medically.
Yeah.
The remaining siblings lived long lives, mostly staying in and around Massachusetts. They seem to have lived long lives, and from many of their obituaries, it's heartwarming to see that they left behind their own families. So out there, if you're listening, there are many descendants. Lots of branches coming out from this. So it just makes me very curious on how they carried their sister's story generation after generation.
Yeah.
And there was only one of the siblings, Jenny, who actually had in her obituary listing the late Maria as her, being her sister. The rest didn't mention it, but, you know, they're kind of short. So today, a small plaque marker is at the site, and after over 100 years have passed, the shadow of that day still lingers over the North End. And some people swear you can still smell molasses on a hot summer day.
Wow.
That's what they're saying. So that was my story. I definitely feel like I learned a lot, and I guess I didn't understand that there were, you know, 21 lives lost. That's, you know, that's not nothing. Mm-hmm. And especially innocent children, you know, and to think that his sibling, or Anthony, her sibling, made it, like, he also had a very tragic story of how he got out. So
were there pictures of the tanks? I'm just trying to wrap my head around how big that had to be to hold millions of gallons.
I did grab one. If I don't have it on my document here, I definitely saw one. So I said the same thing, like, it must have stood out like a eyesore in the town, you know. I will post it. A lot of the photos I saved were all of sort of the devastation of what had happened. But if you can just, like, I'll show you quick here. Like, that's a lot of the damage.
That's a whole...
it's a large area.
It looks like a hurricane came through. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yep. So, I'll get you that other picture. But this is the tenant buildings. Just... and even when he bought that house on 203 Salem Street, like, it was a couple streets over. So, he never left that area.
Wow.
You know, so...
he built that community.
Yeah, and he always was on all the censuses. He was kind of a laborer. He, at one point, it was like building stones and construction type thing. So, but yeah, so I finally got to do my story. I hope I did the family justice and
definitely,
and, you know, making sure the story is told out there for them. So So if you head over to our Facebook page, you can, you know, see some of these photos that we've posted on, you know, this and prior episodes. And we're really starting to build a community on the page now. So lots of followers. So I'm excited about that. So please make sure you check that out. Follow us. And then if you have any family shadows yourself, please email us at shadowsfromthetree@gmail.com. But we did also get a shadow spotlight for this episode. So someone else who shared their family story.
Mm-hmm.
So the shadow spotlight today comes from our listener, Stacy, who shared the story of her two times great-grandfather, Isaac McWilliams, and an industrial disaster that struck at Mound City, Missouri in 1877. So Stacy first learned about Isaac's death through Family Search, and where the dates didn't match up and there wasn't really any natural explanation, she started digging, as most of us
yes.
do.
Yes, time to go down the rabbit hole.
The clue that changed everything for her was an old newspaper article, again, where all yep. the good details are, describing the explosion of the Mound City flouring mill. The article listed several men who were killed, including some identified as J. McWilliams, a teamster who was hauling wood to the mill. Even though the initial wasn't correct, the event referenced in the document was later found and on Ancestry and for Family Search, and she pieced it all together that that person was in fact J. McWilliams, her second great grandfather. I mean, Isaac McWilliams. According to the article, the explosion happened between 3 and 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon when the mill's boiler blew with terrible force, demolishing the entire building and burying 5 people in the ruins. One victim lived only a few minutes afterwards, long enough to say that the explosion just came about 2 minutes and a half too soon. So I'm assuming they would have been on break or something would have changed where they could have gotten
yeah.
out. The article also noted that the true case of the accident would never be known because everyone in the mill at that time was killed and, you know, the extensive damage, but the wrecked boiler suggested that the water had simply run out. Stacy explained that this branch of her family tree has always been difficult to trace, and after learning about Isaac's sudden death, it helped clarify why, because his widow, Amanda Caroline Gibson McWilliams, later married a man named Porter McNate and had 3 more children. So Stacy shared that a touching detail that she had learned about where Amanda, near the end of her life, reportedly said that she wished she could live for the sake of her children, but she was ready and willing to go.
Aww.
So, you know, she had no choice, Amanda, but to
yeah.
remarry and, you know, continue her family. And that's probably why it got so skewed, different last names. It was yeah. hard to trace. But for Stacy uncovering this tragedy, you know, it brought a deeper understanding of what her ancestors lived through. It connected scattering records, explained missing pieces in her tree, and shed light on how Isaac's death reshaped the family that followed. And that's, you know, what we love about most about dark genealogy, these forgotten tragedies, these quiet struggles, these moments that shape an entire family line without anyone realizing it
mm-hmm.
until we speak about it.
Right.
Isaac's story is one of those moments, and we're grateful to Stacy for sharing it with us and allowing us to shine a light onto another shadow.
Yes, thanks, Stacy. And if you're a listener and you want, you know, your family highlighted, we're more than happy to show your stories.
Yeah, perfect. So that's us, and we hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll be back.
Thanks for listening.